Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. We own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Aces.
I have a piece here, just because I read too many newspapers. I have a piece from the Guardian in London.
You know what? I used to think we read a lot back before we had a radio show when we were just on two restaurants, and we were trying to read as much about restaurants and food as we possibly could. But the ungodly amount of paper that comes across my desk now is just phenomenal.
Dorks. We're dorks. But here, this is from the, so basically, we have search engines that we got, and we look for all food related things. Come, you know, various newsletters we'll pull from various publications.
And also from you, we get a ton of information. Yeah. There are four or five of you that must send me six or seven things a week. And while I really appreciate it, my wife's getting mad at you.
And there are hundreds of you who send us one off food ideas, and you know, we look at them all, we consider them all, and we put them in the hopper, and it's great to hear.
It's great. We really appreciate all the stuff that you send us.
Okay, this is from The Guardian in London. The American burger restaurant Wendy's added a fresh fruit bowl to its menu at the end of last year. The company quietly killed it, blaming lack of demand. And this is a quote from the company. "We listened to customers who said they wanted to eat fresh fruit," a disarmingly honest spokesman told The New York Times. But apparently they lied.
You know, I think that I think there's a twofold reason for that. And one is that people who are really, really focused on what they're going to eat at each meal are slowing in going to restaurants like Wendy's. They're trying to find alternatives. The second thing there is I think that we really like burgers better than fresh fruit.
Well, when you ask people about it, I think one of the things that they're finding is that people's actions don't always line up with their intentions. If you ask people what they are, sometimes they'll tell you what they'd like to be. Mm-hmm. But when it comes, you know, when the rubber hits the road, you know, and you're standing in the front of that line and you're like, "Can I have a salad? No, make a double cheeseburger." Here's the deal. The industry mistake, it seems, according to The Guardian, had been to listen to the market researchers who ask the customers, instead of food psychologists. People tell researchers what they think they want to hear or what respondents want to believe about themselves. So there's been all sorts of research. We've had a couple of food psychologists on the show, and I find it very interesting. There are some examples here of what they do. We found out things like people drink more than a third more fruit juice if they pour it into a short, wide glass instead of a tall, narrow one.
All right. You know what? Shame on everybody, okay? Because conservation of matter, I remember it was second or third grade, you're supposed to know that the short wide glass has the same amount in it as the tall skinny glass.
Psychological. And people will eat more of a product if it comes in a bigger package, which is why big gulps are contributing to obesity in America. People will report a breakfast bar tastes worse if the packaging describes it as having soy, even if it has no soy. But here's a little experiment they did.
And then there are definitely certain buzzwords that will increase the perception of what someone's eating or decrease the perception of what someone's eating. And low fat and soy are words like that all of a sudden something people will think that it doesn't taste as good because you've used those words.
So check this out. It's also these food psychologists do research on size of containers like we were talking about a moment ago. But check this out. Andrew Geyer, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, did a study, and he placed a large bowl of M&Ms in the lobby of an apartment building with a sign next to it that said, "Eat your fill. Please use the spoon to serve yourself." He left it there for 10 days in a row, alternating between using a teaspoon and a spoon that holds a quarter of a cup. When they were using the bigger spoon, people on average took two-thirds more M&Ms. And they call that, they have a term for it. It's called unit bias. Mm-hmm. So if you order the supersize, you probably don't want it. You know, we have that you have to finish what's on your plate mentality.
That is definitely the mentality. And you also have the, you know what, and I got to say that I've become a victim to this at times.
Victim of that.
victim of that. No, I'm not. Stop it.
Okay.
But I become a victim of that at times. You go into a store and the 20-ounce version, and you know that you're going to eat it in one sitting or drink it in one sitting. The 20-ounce version is $1 and the 12-ounce version is 95 cents. So you find yourself saying, well, even if I don't eat the whole thing or whatever, it's 5 more cents, I'll just have the bigger one.
Yeah.
And without fail, once you've spent that 5 extra cents, which cost whoever made it probably 2 extra cents, so they're happy they made 3 extra cents on the deal, and you're unhappy because you're eating or drinking more than you wanted
to.
You
think you're happy there in a moment. Well, here's one of the things they point to. The other thing is that there may be an anti-fast food backlash. Right? I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. There may be a backlash to the anti-fast food backlash. People saying, and the industry is out there with some websites, some quote-unquote freedom of choice websites that are saying, hey, you know, don't take away my freedom of choice. Mm-hmm. Look, nobody's trying to take away your freedom of choice.
Absolutely.
We're just trying to let you know that two double Big Macs a day is going to make you fat and unhealthy. Okay? Now, the typical person going to a fast food restaurant, they say, is not driving a BMW and having an expense account with lots of options, lots of time, and more likely to be educated about food choices. They're likely to be less educated and therefore more subject to advertising. And there's a growing sentiment that people don't like being told what to eat by self-righteous critics. Again, we're just telling you what's going to happen when you put that in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not saying you shouldn't be able to do it, except for kids in schools where I say,
right,
no, they shouldn't have a choice because you're a kid. Get it? But right now, there's this advertising. People are advertising the monster thick burger, okay? The Hardee's proudly announces that it's not necessarily politically correct. Burger King advertises the stacker with the manly slogan, stack it high, tough guy. The whole concept is to size it your way, right? The stacker quad is four patties, okay? So the BK Stacker Quad is just a ridiculously enormous amount of food, but somehow it appeals to this, be a man, eat more food.
Right, I can eat more. And, you know,
don't listen to these lily-livered critics of telling you that you need to eat vegetables. And you know what? Yeah, you're going to be a fat guy sitting on the couch when you're older, you know, waiting for your insulin shot.
There is going to be a backlash. In this country, we kind of go from one thing to the next, and you do indeed have backlashes, but I was really hoping that the backlash would be the one that's just begun, and the backlash would be to more real foods.
And I think that it is. And I'll tell you, the one thing that these fast food chains are finding is that they are getting some benefit from having the salad on the menu, from having the healthy food on the menu, but they're finding that even though it's not being ordered, and we know we do this, when we talk about our restaurant, we look at the veto. Who can veto a party? And they're trying to get they call it the veto vote or the mom vote, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea is if there's a family is going to go to a fast food joint, if there's nothing there healthy.
Right, if one of them is on a
one
diet.
One of them is going to say, we can't go there, I can't eat anything there. But if they have the salad there and mom says, well, you know, at least I can get a salad, mm-hmm. They eliminate that veto vote. Even though they've sold one salad and 9 hamburgers, that salad allowed them to sell those 9 hamburgers.
And, you know, even in the restaurant, we know we like to carry a vegetarian item, a fine dining vegetarian item all the time. One of the reasons for that is because of that exact veto vote. If there's one vegetarian in a group, they can convince the whole group not to go to a restaurant because it doesn't offer them a choice.
So if you believe in this stuff, keep buying good food, keep demanding good food, keep asking for good food, and keep eating locally. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guests today are Don and Petey Cladstrup. They're journalists who've written a couple of great books. Actually, one of them is one of my favorite books on wine. It was published in 2002 called Wine and War, The French, the Nazis, and the Battle for France's Greatest Treasure. And more recently, they've written Champagne, How the World's Most Glamorous Wine Triumphed Over War and Hard Times.
Don and Petey, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And
Thank you.
From where are you guys speaking to us today?
We are speaking to you from our farm in Normandy, where we spend most of our time. So we are permanent residents of France at the moment, although we occasionally sneak into Paris for a bit of time as well.
So that's not Normandy, New Jersey, you're
calling.
That's
not Normandy Beach, right.
That's right.
Far from it.
Yeah, and actually, and when one goes to Paris, one should sneak in. It's more fun that way, I think. Now, both of your books, and Wine and War really blew me away when I read it. And we're going to link on our website to both of your books. So if folks out there want to pick them up, you can go to restaurantguysradio.com and find out more about these books and these authors and actually click through and buy them. Both of your books deal with French wine, and they both explore the place of wine in French society and culture. It's much more than an economic, you know, a commodity. I mean, isn't that...
They think of it very differently than we.
Is that a fair characterization of your books?
Absolutely. We were really struck with that when we first moved to France nearly 30 years ago and found that it seemed to permeate all aspects of life in France. And although the economic aspect is very important, as you pointed out, it does go well beyond that. It seems to be just an integral part not only of everyone's literature and history knowledge, but also of their daily lives. It's not an unusual thing to say, well, should we have a bottle of wine for dinner tonight? It's just assumed that someone will have opened the bottle and it will be on the table.
Which bottle are we going to have as opposed to should we?
Yes.
Right. I mean, one person that we talked to, you know, talked about this reflection of the French national character. He said of wine, he said, it's what defines us. It gives us wit, gaiety, and good taste, qualities that set us apart from a nation of beer drinkers, referring, of course, to the Germans.
Yeah, of course. Well, now, you know, as we're becoming more aware in the United States, and the American wine market is now, economically speaking, the driving wine market in the world, but I often bemoan some of the aspects of American wine culture. You know, this idea of, you know, it's a game that has a score and you can win and you can lose. It's very different. Do you want to compare it all, sort of the way Americans, even American wine enthusiasts, react to wine as opposed to French wine enophiles?
I'm not sure how to answer that question. I know that at least the people around here, the normal French types who drink a little wine with each meal, have a little bit each day, they do not seem to be driven by the scores of Robert Parker or Wine Spectator like Americans are. It's much more a natural part of their lives when they go out and buy wine and enjoy it at home.
Because they do that, there also is almost an inherited sense of preference. Oh, this is the wines we buy. These are the ones we like. That is the guiding force for it, as well as whatever it is they're having for dinner that night, something that's going to go well with it, and something that they feel comfortable with. It isn't going to be a famous name night after night after night. It's going to be really a table wine for their table.
What I found in France and with the family I lived with when I was in France was that it was also a pride issue, a pride in where you came from and the wines from your area. And so what I found is that a lot of the families that I spoke with and the family that I lived with, their preference was for the wines from where they came from.
I think that's true. You're used to them. There's something you're familiar with. You're comfortable with them. And you probably know the makers, either, if not personally, by reputation, which explains, of course, why here in Normandy everybody drinks apple cider.
Yeah, I think, you know, on the part of the French, at least the people who drink wine as a normal custom, there's less analyzing. There's less philosophizing. It's simply something to drink, something to enjoy, something to add to a meal.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, one of the things that we do, I mean, we sell a lot of wine. We do a lot of restaurant consulting for other restaurants. We used to have our own wine shop, and now we have two restaurants still that have, you know, pretty extensive wine lists. And our wines are, you know, New Jersey wines are nothing I want to drink. But in the wines in the different places where I go and visit, people often want to buy a wine from me that because they know they trust my palate. But it's also, I know the story. I know the producer. I know where it came from. And sometimes that story is expressed in the taste in the bottle. And it strikes me that that's how things are in French culture overall when they look at wine. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think it is. And certainly it's something we have become very attached to as an idea. when we get to know the winemakers in a certain area, when we get to know the people who have actually made the champagne we're drinking, that wine, that champagne, automatically gets better.
Well,
now, one of the real joys that we've had is going into the, well, going visiting some of the small producers in Champagne. They make wines that would not have a house style. These are not the big champagnes. These are small champagnes that you know, reflect the terroir.
And they're different from
the land that they were grown from.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Don and Petey Cloudstrip about Champagne and their book, Champagne, How the World's Most Glamorous Wine Triumphed Over War and Hard Times. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The maragatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Don and Petey Cloudstrip are our guests. Their books that we're talking about today are Wine and War and also the book Champagne, which has just recently come out. Why a whole book devoted just to champagne?
Well, I think because it was something that absolutely fascinated us more and more as we were working on Wine and War, because every place we went in Champagne on that, while we were researching our first book, people would say to us, oh, you're talking about World War II. Yeah, yes, that was terrible. But it was nothing compared to World War I. And going on back through time, they had one war after another that they were discussing with us, that they were mentioning, and it was then that we realized that Champagne may have been the piece of land the most fought over, the most bloodied in the entire world. For centuries, for generations, this has been a land of conflict.
Yeah, Champagne has suffered an overdose of invasions. And for us, the challenge was answering the question, you know, how could a land that has been drenched with so much blood and seen so much hardship also be the birthplace of a wine that the whole world regards as a symbol of good times, friendship, and celebration.
Now, was Champagne so fought over because it's on the way to Paris, or is it that people wanted Champagne itself?
It's a combination of things. It was not on the way to Paris in the beginning. Paris was there, but Paris was just a tiny town. Reims was the capital of Champagne, was a much bigger city than Paris. What it was on the way to were all of the major trading routes. The north-south route, the east-west route in Europe cut right through Champagne, and that made it, of course, a very important piece of real estate.
And with the advent of the Champagne industry and Champagne there, there was a benefit to, which may not have been a benefit to, a lot of the soldiers passing through that would raid the cellars and drink the Champagne. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that was, shall we say, Champagne's secret weapon. By the time the soldiers got to the Champagne cellars and had raided them, they were so drunk that they were not very good fighters anymore.
There's actually a great story about that I'd love for you to retell after the news.
You're listening to us talk with Don and Petey Cloudstrip about their wonderful books, Champagne and Wine and War, which you can find out more about on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll link you up with how to find them. We'll be talking with them more after the news about war and the battles for French wine and the surprising role that French wine took in a lot of the battles throughout France. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, the time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every Monday through Friday from 11 to noon. Reach through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guests today are Don and Petey Cladstrup. They are journalists and writers who've authored two great books that we're talking about today, Wine and War, The French, the Nazis, and the Battle for France's Greatest Treasure, and Champagne, How the World's Most Glamorous Wine Triumphed Over War and Hard Times.
So you were, Petey, you were talking just before the break about how champagne would occasionally weaken the German army and make them easier pickings for the French army, as it were. Can you tell us a little story about that?
Absolutely. The Champenois twigged on to this very quickly, that champagne could be their, what they came to call in World War One, their dearest ally. By letting them have a taste of champagne, the Germans quickly turned into not merely dead, but dead drunk along the routes, and the French armies could walk right over them, and as they did in World War One, at one point, say they harvested them like grapes.
That should be a strategy. Just on the invading army, you should just drop bottles of champagne by parachute, by cases.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, there was a Civil War general, Philip Sheridan, who had gone over as a just to kind of scout things out and see how the war was going, and he wrote about this entire episode in his memoirs, and he talked about this incredibly long road of just covered with shattered glass, and he commented that the amount of champagne that the Germans had consumed must have been enormous.
Well,
this
was
the Franco-Prussian War, so as early as 1870, the Germans were coveting champagne, and the French always felt that that was the reason the Germans went to war against France, was that they coveted the
champagne.
That's right. They may have exaggerated a little, but certainly there were plenty of political incidents that involved champagne being a determining factor, such as when King Wenceslas went to Champagne to settle the schism in the Catholic Church in the 15th century. He got so drunk on champagne that he couldn't stand up, and it took a couple of French dukes to get him to sign the treaty. And in the end, he gave the French king everything he asked for.
Hmm. That's
a little champagne. I'll do that. I had a date like that once.
Congratulations.
Oh, my goodness. It's a family show. Now, so that's one instance where an invading army raiding the cellars of champagne was probably not such a great idea for the invading army. But I remember I was in Austria. The first time I visited Austria, before I knew what an amazing wine region that was and how important wine was to the winemaking regions of Austria. And a very nice gentleman who was hosting me opened a bottle of wine of his birth year. And it had been the family had hidden the wine for 10 years, first from the Nazis and then from the Soviets who occupied his family's estate. And what they had done was they had taken many cases of their best wine and threw them into the bottom of a very deep lake and fished that wouldn't freeze through, and then fished them out 10 years later. And I was amazed by that story, and I was amazed by that wine. But in your book, you have lots of stories like that of how the French did similar things. How did the French protect their valuable wines?
Well, in World War II, there were all sorts of ways. Many producers simply hid their best bottles behind brick walls that they erected in their cellars. Others buried their bottles in rubbish piles. In World War I, somebody put their bottles, one chateau owner dumped his bottles in a pond behind the chateau. But that one backfired because as the Germans arrived on his premises, they peered out over the pond, and they noticed all these floating labels on the top. So it doesn't always work, but really the French were very inventive when it came to hiding their wine.
Well, I always found it intriguing how some of the French were you know, able to surrender their guns, but really reticent to surrender their wines.
Yeah, well.
Now
we're talking about the old wine you drank. We a few months ago staged a wine and war dinner and drank some of the wines that we wrote about in that book, and some of them had been hidden throughout the war year period, and that was unbelievable to have a taste of them.
You know, we talk about the wines having a story, you know, and that being part of the allure of the wine and being able to taste that in the bottle. When someone goes to such tremendous, I mean, they risk their lives to protect this product. I mean, the wine takes on a whole new meaning when you drink it, especially when they're kind enough to share it with you. Why would they risk life and limb to protect their wines? I mean, the Germans weren't really slap on the wrist kind of people. You know what I mean? They could get in serious trouble if the Germans.
You were risking a lot, perhaps your life.
Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, particularly in World War I, in the Champagne region. I mean, you had old men, women, and children going out to take care of their vines, bring in the grapes, even as German shells were falling all around them, falling for more than 1,000 consecutive days. Many people were killed. And I guess, you know, to answer your question, it's a way of life. It's their economy. It's their whole livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
But it even goes beyond that.
I was going to say it would have to because, you know, we can all get another job.
Yeah. For people, particularly when we were in Champagne, we became aware of how attached they are to their individual plots of vines, that these are personal heritage from their grandfathers, their great-grandfathers, their great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers. It goes back so far that this is the vine that Aunt Mary planted when she was doing something else or when she married Uncle George. They all have a story to tell, not just the bottles of wine, the bottles of champagne, but the individual vines. And that is something that became really touching to us as we talked to the growers in Champagne, as well as to the champagne makers.
I liken it to if they were books, you know, although they're and Americans have trouble seeing wine this way, I think, because it's a consumable. But old vintages, you know, they are part of your past, and it's as if there was a library, a family library, handed down generation after generation, and there was an invading army coming in. You might risk, you know, being punished by the Germans to hide some of your more valuable and treasured pieces. Is that a fair analogy?
Yes, I think it is. In fact, many of the winemakers in France do have this reserve of old wines that they do call their library. And in it, they will have wines that not only they made, but they have exchanged through generations with their fellow winemakers. And this is true particularly, I think, in Bordeaux, where there are huge collections that have just been shared amongst the winemakers in the region. But in all the other regions, too, there is this to a greater or lesser extent. And it is something that just really hit home to us with a wine from the Marquis d'Angerville, who had never tasted what was considered the greatest wine his father had ever made, and went out of his way to search out this 1934 wine and buy it back wherever he could to bring it back to the family because they'd had to sell it all to start business after World War II.
That's wild. You know, I think that people will get a great deal of a kick out of seeing how the French survived during occupation. And one of the things that you cover that I think was really great, and it's not just for winemaking families, is that people who had collections and restaurateurs would put their worst wine in really nice bottles and serve it and try to pass it off to the Germans as the really special thing.
And fake dust.
Did anyone ever get it? Did people get in trouble for trying to hide wine from the Germans when they were found out?
Well, yes. A fellow named Tétinger during World War II really muffed it once when he tried to foist off some of his lesser wine on the Germans. There was a guy in charge of the whole region named Klebisch. And you know what Tétinger I don't know failed to realize is that Klebisch had a very, very fine palate. He knew what good champagne was.
Actually, we're going to leave this as a cliffhanger because we're going to come back in just a moment, and you're going to find out what happened to Monsieur Tartanger when he tried to hide his wine from the Germans when we come back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, with Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. And we left you with a bit of a cliffhanger. We're talking with Don and Petey Cladstrip about their books, Champagne, How the World's Most Glamorous Wine Triumphed Over War and Hard Times. And we're also talking to them about wine and war. Now, we left it with Monsieur Tartanger of the House of Champagne and Tartanger had
made a little mistake,
and tried to hold on to his good wines while giving the Germans second-rate wines. And what happened?
Yeah, it was François Tartanger. He was in charge of things, and he decided that he was going to try to foist off a bit of lesser champagne on the so-called wine Führer, a guy named Otto Klebisch. And Tartanger just did not realize or appreciate the fact that Klebisch had one of the best palates in the German army. And so, anyway, he offloaded the champagne. It had been ordered by Klebisch. Klebisch, tasted it and immediately summoned Tartanger to his office. And, he looked at François and he said, "What do you think of this?" And François, nodded and said, "Well, it's pretty good." And Klebisch came back and he says, "I think it's," and he uttered a four-letter word.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "How dare you try to foist off dirty ditch water on the German army?" To which Tartanger responded, "Well, it's not like Germans know anything about good wine."
Oof.
And that ended Tartanger ended up in the clink for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the Germans didn't like to be insulted like that. But, good for him. One of the things that I think people don't realize, and let's focus on your most recent book, Champagne. If you haven't been to Champagne and been in the caves of Champagne and been underground in Champagne, you can't really appreciate how completely unique and special the brilliant white cellars of chalk are and how deep they go. You talk in your books about how the people of Champagne sort of made a life underground at some point when they were under attack. Will you talk to us about that?
Oh, those caves were absolute lifesavers. And they were lifesavers at a time when the Prussians began opening up and bombarding the city of Reims constantly for 1,052 consecutive days. The entire city was leveled. The entire population, just about, retreated underground for protection. It was as if the entire city had been flipped upside down. You had City Hall relocated there. You had shops. You had museums. You had schools and churches. Everything was down there, and people stayed for months and months at a time.
And it's absolutely brilliant to be carved out of chalk under there. I mean, there are wine cellars that have ceilings like they're cathedrals, and it's mm-hmm. amazing stuff. My favorite thing.
They date back to probably Roman times when they quarried the chalk under Champagne to build their temples, to build their buildings, to build their roads, because when you bring the chalk up into the air, it dries very, very hard, so that it becomes a wonderful building material. Those caves were largely forgotten until many, many generations later when a few of them were rediscovered. And they began using them to age the champagne, to store the champagne, and then began to expand them to the point that there are what, 300 kilometers worth of cellars underneath Champaign today, which explains why sometimes they could hide cars in the caves when they were being attacked. And the cars could be forgotten, and only, what, about 2 or 3 years ago, they found a car that had been walled up during World War II.
I was amazed the first time I visited. The first time I visited Champaign, I went with a letter of introduction to Claude Tattinger before he died from Kevin Zarelli. So, and the first time I was in those cellars, one of the neat things to do is if you spit red wine into the chalk cellar, it wicks away and disappears into the wall and goes into the center of the earth, evidently, which is
pretty. We'll have to try that sometime.
Oh, it's great! It's a great magic trick. The guy from Tattinger taught me that. Well, we read all the time, we're talking about wine in general and French culture in general, how important it is to French culture, but we read all the time that even the French are drinking less wine, and younger French people are drinking less wine than prior generations. Is wine's position in French culture and society changing?
Not really. I think, you know, as globalization takes place, I think France, like every other country, is getting caught up in you know, the economy and with making profits, et cetera, et cetera. When we settled in France, you know, I mean, three-hour lunches were common. It was hard to get people, you know, out of the restaurants or away from their doggy bag. But all of that has changed. People are not drinking wine with every meal. It's a quick lunch, a power lunch, and they're off to other things. The change is quite startling.
Well as it being a health issue, I think that they have begun to realize that in this case, less is not only important, but better is also important. So they're drinking less wine, but they definitely are drinking higher quality wine. And the producers of the lower quality wines are the ones who are really suffering.
Mm-hmm. Which is the same thing we're doing in this country.
All I have to say is that I aspire to a three-hour lunch as a regular part of my life. I'd like to get there at some point. Don and Petey Klaustrup, thanks for joining us on The Restaurant Guys today. You've been great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Don and Petey Klaustrup. Their books are Champagne and Wine and War. Wine and War is one of my favorite books, and Champagne is great, too. You can find out more about those books by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Click right through, and I'll tell you a funny story. I read Wine and War when it came out in 2002. And then I was given it as a present the following year, and then I was given it as a present the following year, and then I think I re-gifted one of those to you, didn't I?
You did.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Living, Capital Lombardi.
You know, one of the things that in talking to Don and Petey and reading their books that you realize is that this area of the world was besieged for almost the first half of the 20th century. I mean, my father was born in France in the late 30s, moved to the United States as a young boy in 46, but spent his life living in France during this war.
I was going to say, he moved, I understand that's due to an extreme aversion to machine gun fire.
Well, and his parents lived in France before that, during World War One, I mean, just as children. And I think that one of the things we don't realize in
40
this,
years before that, the Prussians had invaded.
One of the things we don't realize in this country is that this area, when you talk about, you know, they went through their lives, they planted their grapes, they lived their lives outside of the war, that was necessary. I mean, you're talking about in 23 years, with 23 years in between, they suffered through World War One and World War Two. I mean, it's just not that very much time of peace when you compare it to the time they spent under siege. And, you know, my father lived on a farm that wasn't really besieged, and his parents lived in the city, and they worked, and they sent money to pay for him to be raised in a relatively safe place. And in those places, you had to continue to grow your apples and you had to continue to grow your grapes. And because the country had to go on, people in the country had to go on. They had to produce the food for the entire country.
I'm reminded of, you know, there's a sensibility that comes out of that where you have an attachment to the food and the food of where you come from and an appreciation for the specialness of food. And I remember we talked to Bureau, you know, the chef Bureau. He was born in in East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a chef in East Germany. And he said, you know, that, while I didn't have the broadest experience in food, that taught me great respect for food because it was so rare and so mm-hmm. precious. And, you know, though we live though we live in a land of abundance, I think we need to realize that locally produced food is precious and
part of culture. One of my favorite stories is my father scraping the butter off of his bread so that his sister could have butter on her bread. her scraping butter off of her bread so her sister could have butter on it. Yeah, things have changed for us.
Hey, let's go get a supersized burger. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Scott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450 times 12 noon.